Hey, thanks everybody for joining us on the latest edition of News of the Money World. My name is Darcy Ungaro, and your name, Rupert, is Rupert Carline. Hey, yeah. So today we're going to cover 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 topics in half an hour. We're going to do our best, right?
I've only got 4 on my list, so I'm waiting for the curveballs.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot to tell you about that, but we'll get into that as we go. Sorry, this is on my list, not the list that you have. But let's start with something nice and non-controversial, like tax cuts. Yeah. Are they inflationary? Your view, and like I think pretty much everybody's view, especially when I was like 3 paragraphs into reading something from Chloe Swarbrook on the Herald before I realized who was writing it. Something wasn't quite right. And then I realized, yeah, that's right. But yeah, tax cuts. So apparently they're not good for the economy. They're quite inflationary. You would have that view as well. So I have to be a little bit respectful to that. My view is a little bit like, well, hey, we've got interest rates that are so unbelievably high that I still have the view that that would be more than offsetting the impacts of these tax cuts. But do you want to break down just the rationale, the reasoning behind why these tax cuts are indeed inflationary?
So look, let's go back to core basics, right? The reason that inflation is high is because the demand that we're placing on services and goods is higher than the supply that people can supply those goods. So laws of supply and demand mean when supply is more short, demand is high, prices go up. And so that's what we've seen here. So what they do is effectively the Reserve Bank uses interest rates to bring the level of, and the reason why there's more kind of demand for goods than there is supply is 2 reasons, right? I think we can kind of pretty clearly agree at the moment it's due to way too much cash sloshing around in the economy. Well, sorry, that's the one reason. The 2 sub reasons underneath that, the Reserve Bank kind of went nuts with their money, loose monetary policy. So lots and lots of free money floating around. Plus, we had a government that was spending way too much, running a deficit of about 7% of GDP. So let's kind of agree on that fact.
Yeah.
At the moment, we've got high inflation because we've got too much money sloshing around in the economy. So what does the Reserve Bank do? So the Reserve Bank, what they will do is they will look to raise interest rates to mean that less money is sloshing around in the economy. Because if people have to pay higher mortgage costs, the companies have to pay more interest on their debts, it means that households rein in their budgets because their mortgage rate's gone from 2% to 7%. Companies are seeing the same thing. So any expenditure that's discretionary gets reined in. So we've got all this limited supply of money coming into the economy because of the higher interest rates. Which that's what the Reserve Bank is trying to do. And now, what do tax cuts do? Tax cuts now mean that we've got an extra $14.8 billion of money flowing back into the economy. And so it's kind of like we've got the Reserve Bank trying to take money out of the economy, and then we've got the government who's going, no, I made these election promises, so therefore I need to funnel money back into the economy. And so I'm not debating for a second that Kiwis deserve tax cuts. At the end of the day, the truth is that those tax cuts should be adjusted, those tax thresholds should be adjusted each and every year.
Totally.
Because fundamentally, right, they're kind of, the thresholds are actually 30% higher on a real basis than when they were last adjusted back in 2011. And that's just not fair or right.
Yeah.
So I do believe that tax cuts are deserved and should be coming. I just don't believe that now is the right time, because they are pumping more money into the economy at a time when we should be taking money out to control inflation. And I would actually argue that the everyday Kiwi is better off with lower interest rates than they are with tax cuts. And so that's why my view is they just have to be inflationary. And actually, I think in terms of helping middle class New Zealand, which is what this budget was meant to do, lower interest rates would have been better. And actually, I'm not an economist, but kind of all of the banks have come out subsequently saying this will add to the inflationary pressure, and it's likely to mean that interest rates get delayed. It's clear the government don't want to hear that statement, but that's what we are seeing.
Yeah. I'm looking at it just from my own personal perspective, right? So consider me the, and you'd probably in a similar bucket.
Yeah.
I worked out on the tax calculator that I'm saving $44 a fortnight with these tax cuts, but I'm still paying just over $1,267 a fortnight on my mortgage that recently I had to refix. And so that part, like I get the fact that at a macro level, these tax cuts are kind of flying in the face of the efforts on the monetary side, like the fiscal is at odds with the monetary efforts. But in terms of magnitude, it just feels like it's such a tiny little drop in the ocean from at a micro level in my own household level. And when I think about how tax cuts would work, it would be a broad release of new money evenly across the economy. And yeah, I would assume that the lower you are on that income side of the equation, you're more likely to spend that money. Yeah, that tax cut would be instantly inflationary at a point downwards. They might not own a home. And so it's probably only when you go a little bit further up to a point where, again, it's that sandwich middle that's just nailed with these things. So we have this, I guess it's a bit of cognitive dissonance that goes on here where you have these two competing forces, the fiscal and the monetary. We don't want to create the inflation anymore. We want to tamper it out. At the same time, there's a certain need, right? So we want the economy to crash so that we can stamp out inflation, but then we don't want the damage that comes with it. We can't have our cake and eat it too, right? That seems to be the problem.
Definitely not. And I think that's part of the issue, right? And look, only time will tell. I personally believe that I don't think this has helped. I don't think it was the responsible path. I mean, even when we look at it, right? So we've now pushed out the kind of when we get out of deficit by another couple of years, and someone described it perfectly as Nicola Willis has been educated by Bill English, and Bill English had the amazing path of saying, in 4 years' time, we're going to have the absolutely perfect surplus, a tiny surplus, and every year it was pushed out, and every year there was the promise. And that's kind of what we've got, right? But let's be really clear. If the government is spending more money than they have, that will always be inflationary. For the better part of the last 20 years or 15 years, it hasn't mattered because we've had a very low inflation environment. But now we do. And we've also got all of these other dynamics that are hitting us around aging population, infrastructure deficit, all of these other reasons, which actually mean that we're going to have other pressures. So I do firmly believe that we are going to have to do something different. And I don't think this is helpful.
Yeah, no, I think, though, to be honest, I think, hey, inflation, it ain't our problem, right? It's actually government and central bank, like you said at the beginning. So if someone's going to wear the pain, it shouldn't be us, it should be them. But good luck trying to get a politician to do the right thing here, right?
Because they're and I think that this is kind of, and so there's some interesting stuff coming out of the US and there's some interesting stuff coming out of it now. Unfortunately, I think what we are seeing through this kind of this cost of living crisis is it's actually the middle that's getting squeezed.
Oh yeah.
Because at the lower end of incomes, you have seen kind of pretty good rises in minimum wage. You have seen rises, kind of pretty good wages at rises at the lower end. It's the middle where we're not seeing a lot of those rises. Kind of the salary increases aren't going anywhere near as much. It's also the middle, which, to be blunt, we've all got mortgages that we took out 3 years ago that we can't afford to service anymore. And so you're kind of seeing it across a whole spectrum of things where top end, those guys are doing really, really well still because cost of living crisis doesn't really matter because they've got so much money. It's the middle that's really kind of desperately squeezed here. And I don't think these tax cuts are really there to help it.
Okay. So let's move on, though, to the state of the New Zealand economy, because I think you could probably almost make this comment in most parts of the world, but for some pretty fundamental reasons, and I think, I'd point to the central bank for this, New Zealand is first to enter into most of the events that have come our way as it relates to the response post-2020, and that would include feeling the effects of the recession. Possibly it's not made much easier because of our fixed rate tendencies on our mortgages. So those of us in the middle that do have mortgages, fixing for 1 or 2 years, if we're really a long-term thinker, well, that's not really long-term. And as a result, we're feeling the effects of higher for longer faster. And that's flowing through into the economy, because when there's less new credit created in a system, like blood pressure coming out of a system, things slow down, things don't work as well. And we're now at that stage where we're basically using things like immigration to prop it up.
Yeah.
But in terms of like the where to from here part of this, how deep, how far do we need to go into recession, do you think, before we're going to see some relief on the monetary side with lower interest rates?
I'm really curious on this, and because I'm hopeful, but I think it's going to happen a lot faster than you expect, right? And for a couple of reasons. So one of the things the Treasury forecast did do was they spelt out just how bad the state of the economy was. We're at minus 2.9% on GDP per capita. Like, that is insane, right? So that's saying everyone's getting 2.9% poorer. The last time it was close to this number, it was GFC. And so I think there's that piece there, right? So we know that actually our productivity is getting worse, we're getting poorer, and we're kind of doing less. As you say, it's been propped up by inflation. Immigration. I actually suspect, and I might be wrong here, but immigration is likely to hit a massive brick wall. And I think we might very quickly see it going the other way from where it has for two reasons. One is coming back to that squeezed middle. Looking at the stats through last week, right, we saw kind of, I think it was 55,000 people leaving New Zealand, right? And these are highly skilled, typically. They're highly skilled, educated people. These are our doctors, our nurses, our teachers that are sitting there going, well, you know what? Life's pretty tough here in New Zealand at the moment. I can go to Australia and take a 40% pay rise. Why wouldn't I do that? So I think we're really seeing the cost of having an economy that's going slower than Australia right now.
Mm.
The second reason why I think immigration is going to kind of hit a brick wall is a lot of the immigrants were coming in to do construction work, infrastructure projects, a lot of that kind of stuff. And talking to a few immigration firms and talking to a few employers in that space, that work is drying up. So I was talking to a couple of companies that bring in workers from the Philippines to help on some of the large infrastructure projects. They can't find work for all the workers that they've got here in New Zealand at the moment. So part of me does go, look, I do think that we are about to see the end of the cycle. And so if we're in a world where we've got continued negative GDP per capita, which we will do, there's nothing really that looks to be changing that anytime soon. Plus we don't have the immigration kind of booster that's sitting behind us. It's pretty easy to see us kind of in a world where we're moving pretty quickly into a -1%, -2% kind of GDP growth. And I personally, I think it's going to be really, really hard for the Reserve Bank to hold their nerve on interest rates while that's going on. So I don't think it needs to get too much worse before we start to see some pretty quick movement on those interest rates.
Yeah. So here's the part where, like, I just look at the people that I know, the people that I talk to, and I just wonder what their future looks like, and specifically those that have left. Like you probably know friends. I know, like, I've got quite a few clients that they've rented out their home, or they've dumped it. They've sold it. They're away overseas now, right? They're chasing better money. Really understandable. But this happened kind of like before 2008 global financial crisis. And it's a pattern that you see over and over again where people, they leave to chase the money, right? And then when they come back, they're hit with the reality that house prices have increased, and they usually come back because they have a kid. So there's higher desire to buy a home that they now can afford. And the reason why is because of that dynamic that happens. If we're first to enter recession, which is the reason why they left, we're also likely the first to see interest rate relief, which is the reason why house prices rebound higher faster. So when people lose their jobs overseas in England and in Australia, they come back here after they meet someone with a kid and they buy that house. Understandably, they are going further and further behind. And so in terms of like strategy, one of the best things to consider is just staying the hell put, in my view, because of that reality that if you think you're going to be buying a home or buying a bigger home, that's going to be a little bit harder when you're actually chasing the money, which is,
well, I think there's two parts to it though, right? One is, so my view on that is actually going, you want to hedge out the housing market. And it's kind of a technical way of saying basically buy your house and hold it. If you think you're going overseas for 5 years, I think you need to protect yourself against that risk of what's going to happen in the housing market. So if you don't own a house already, that's kind of fine, but try, if you think one day you might come back to New Zealand, it'd be good to try and buy a house as soon as you can in New Zealand. Or if you're going overseas and you do own a house, look, probably the best answer is going to be rent that house out, figure out what you're going to do offshore as well. I think that is where people have been caught out in the last kind of, or the better part of the last 20 years, is everyone has said the housing market's at its peak, it can't get any further up, and it does. My very strong view on it is you just got to take the hedge, buy the house, maintain your exposure to the property market, and rather than trying to play and time it, right? Because actually by selling today and expecting to buy in the future, that is all you are doing. You are trying to kind of time the market, and we know how hard that is.
Yeah. No, that's so true. Let's go to a different part of the world. Let's go to India and have a chat around that. So elections, pro-business tilt, more economic reform, streamlined regulation, enhanced infrastructure. What's not to like? That sounds awesome. Less government. Sounds really good. Pro-business. Businesses love certainty, right? So where does this go? And do you think that there's going to be a positive flow and effect to New Zealanders if we establish a stronger trading relationship with India?
Definitely. So I think, so coming back to what's happening at the moment, Indian election, the largest democracy in the world, second largest population in the world, also the highest growing large economy in the world. And so that what everyone's really kind of thoughtful and excited about is over the last 10 years, India has been transformed by a single politician called Narendra Modi. And he has done an amazing job at kind of transforming the economy and bringing everything kind of right out into the future. He's also got some pretty nasty populists and political kind of stuff in there, but hey, they all do. And so, but he's kind of, investors are sitting there going, cool, he was massively leading in the polls and everyone was expecting it to be an easy victory for him and easy for him to get a majority. And in things, this is going to be his chance to kind of finalize and fulfill his legacy. And it was going to be a great way, kind of a great another 5 years of Modi. And so you saw over the last couple of weeks, you saw the markets kind of rise pretty sharply, particularly in the last 3 or 4 days. They rose kind of 5, 6, 7%, I think it was, as it looked, the early exit polls made it look as though it was going to be an easy victory. However, last night we saw markets actually, the Indian market tanked 5.5% as a result of all of a sudden he's not going to get his majority and he's going to have to go into a coalition with someone, which is going to mean it's much harder for him to kind of ram through change and ram through regulatory stuff that he needs to do. I think it raises a couple of really interesting questions, right? First and foremost, and we've had this debate before, is authoritarianism actually the best path forward for economic growth? Because at the end of the day, last 10 years, he has been very largely unchecked. He's played a very strong game into that Hindu majority, kind of persecuting a lot of the minorities. And yeah, there's strong arguments around what's happened under human rights with him. And you can see that the markets are now going, fuck, he's going to have to share power. He's going to have to kind of be a whole lot nicer to everyone around him. And the markets are giving them a 5% discount as a result of it. So it is a fascinating way in which the markets are kind of assessing and looking at that, because it has been a truly amazing story, right? India, for the better part of the last 50 years almost, or particularly the last 25, has been the market that never really took off and never really worked. And a lot of that's due to the dysfunctional government. But over the last 10 years, they have made it work. And now investors, we're excited. And now getting really nervous about that as well.
Yeah.
So I haven't actually answered your question, but that's my view.
Yeah, that's okay. Hey, that's why we're here.
So what does all that mean for New Zealand? I guess is another great question. I think it means a lot, because at the end of the day, we are a core part of that as a trading nation, a core part of that Asia Pacific kind of trading group. And with India being largely, with China kind of slowing down and being a bit of slower growth at the moment, India is a massive part of kind of driving the growth of not just of the region, which actually, even though we've got smaller exports to India, a very strong India will pull a whole lot of other people up around it. And that's why for us, it's actually really important that we see ongoing continued growth in India. The other part of the story around a very strong India, which is really important for New Zealand, and whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, depend on kind of your views, is India is a massive source of our immigration. And so increasingly over the last kind of 5-7 years, a lot of Indian graduates are going, hold on a sec, why do I want to go to New Zealand, the US, Australia, these other markets, when I can now get really good, high-paying, very entrepreneurial jobs here in India? And I think that's going to make it, all of a sudden, the idea of immigrating away from India is becoming a whole lot less attractive than it was 15 years ago. And so the flip side of strong economic growth is it's going to make it harder and harder for us to attract those immigrants. So I do think there will be a big impact here in New Zealand. It's all kind of second degree, second order. It's not like China where they import most of our milk, most of our logs, most of our lamb, a whole lot of our wine. So actually that's a first order impact. But a strong India is both good and bad for New Zealand.
Okay. That's interesting. I'm fascinated by like the whole India piece because it feels like it needs to be more of a major influence in New Zealand, like almost to replace that which China currently occupies. It just feels like that's a natural transition to occur.
The problem that we have though is what do we export, right? If we want to do it in export market, milk, they've got a very strong domestic milk market, highly informal market. And so our exports into that market are pretty tough. And the farmers in India have been very adamant that no, we will not take external. It's a much more protected market than even China. I first invested in India in 2006, expecting it to be kind of all of these stories to happen. Unfortunately, I stopped investing in India in 2013 because I kind of kept on getting burnt. And there were these kind of massive highs and lows. I looked at it this morning, actually, the last 4 years, you would have doubled your money if you invested in the Indian stock market, and is now the right time to go for it.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the thing with emerging markets, right? So we have this slice, KiwiSaver funds, or most retirement funds would have an allocation of what, like 5-15% of the most maybe towards emerging markets. Yeah, that's the reason why it's so small, because it's quite volatile, right? Only a little dabble.
Very volatile. And even India makes up about 15% of the kind of the MSCI emerging markets kind of benchmarks. But you're right, it's small, it's hard to access, and very hard to get information on. And also there's a lot of commentary and conversation around the quality of the companies, the level of corruption. It is a very, very hard market to invest in, very similar to China. That's the problem with emerging markets investing, right? Which I think you're probably better to take the theme and take a broader market than try and pick individual names. And that's really, really tough to do.
Yeah. But I guess like when we're thinking about and we overlay geopolitical things, not necessarily risks, but just transformation that's happening, I guess there's probably a risk in being overweight the US. That's where the majority of your returns are probably going to come from. So you don't want to get rid of it. But at the same time, there's a risk on emerging markets, but you kind of need to be just aware of both those pieces. And I know this isn't what we agreed to talk about, but like even things with interest rates and how the economies perform will be very different in each of these regions. And the favorite assets to own will be very different. And so all of this stuff plays into a mix, all the more reason why you probably want to have a little bit of diversification going on, eh?
Massive. And I think that's what we always say, right? You're never quite sure which one's going to go next. Is it China? Is it India? Where is it? And that's the really hard thing. Yeah, can't say it enough times, but portfolio and setting yourself up as an investor is all about that diversification.
Yeah.
Making sure that you are kind of there for when the market goes for it.
Yeah. And I think that level of knowledge required to actually get the portfolio allocation correct is an attainable level of knowledge for most people. Yeah. Whereas like digging into company financials is something that, hey, you know, if you really got a thing for accounting, fill your boots, right? But that's not everybody's cup of tea. So I think that's why if you want to get that right, you at least have a chance as an everyday investor.
But to be blunt, a good investor, it's not about what you read into their accounts. It's about, so kind of being a good investor, it's kind of a three-phase process, right? You've got to understand, do you kind of understand the industry they operate in? Do you understand that company's point of difference and why they can win in that industry? And then do you understand enough about their financial state to make sure that they've got the capability and the financial capability to kind of execute on that plan, right? Because we invest for the future, we don't invest for the past. And the financial statements will only give us a state of today or the past, but actually those first two exercises around understanding the industry and understanding where and how that company fits into it, that's really, really, really hard. And I think that's kind of, that's what a good investor needs to do.
Yeah. Or needs to realize that those three things just aren't really within their skill set. And the great news is that if you recognize that you're either really good or you have a desire to go there in those three areas and really do a good job of that, great. There's a pathway for you. But if you know you're not, that's also good because you're more likely just to trust in the science, right? Like trust in how you allocate the portfolio. And okay, but let's get back to dysfunction, right? So we didn't agree to talk about this, but last week was a pretty big week. And I think it was about a week ago or so where the old Trumpster is getting in trouble. So we got to talk about that, right? Like, are we potentially going to see a president of the United States who is ruling from prison? And if so, what does that look like? Because if I was like running a campaign, I was trying to raise money, I think I would be pushing to get arrested really well as well, because obviously it's brought a lot of money in. Potentially, some are saying that it's really tilted the odds in his favor. I don't know whether that was a strategy or whether something's backfired. But do you think, Rupert, that we're going to see a president from behind bars?
Look, I don't think there's any chance he goes to jail. It's actually a relatively, I read an interesting article on this in the weekend. It's a relatively minor misdemeanor. And actually what was fascinating is that the Justice Department didn't want to take the case up because they thought, oh, it's a minor piece. It doesn't really matter. And it's just a waste of our time to even prosecute this. The previous state attorney in New York made the same decision. It was a new state attorney in New York that kind of got elected on the basis of him saying, I will bring these charges if you elect me, which means that it is very much a political decision to kind of what has happened and where it's gone. But it's pretty hard to see a judge not seeing straight through that and going, yeah, okay, he has been guilty, but it's a small misdemeanor. Here's a small fine. Off you go. We're done here. I think the problem with what they've done is they've actually, by using such a small technical part of the law to bring this case, it's actually removed a whole lot of the legitimacy behind it. Because everyone goes, okay, so he didn't fully disclose the fact that, he falsified a business record, which means that he paid some money out and he said it was a legal expense, but it was actually a hush money expense. I mean, fuck,
we do it all the time, don't we, Rupert? Is that what you're about to say?
No, I don't. You might. I don't. But it's not. It's not a big. And that's, I think, that's where I think most people struggle with. And I think that's where, unfortunately, it's probably reinforced the view for most people that it has been politically motivated, because just like how we described it, they can't get their heads around it and go, well, actually, is that really a crime? Is that really so bad? Surely people do that all the time. I label my coffee expense as a kind of a shopping expense. I mean, whatever, right? Like, it's, yeah. So that's why I think it's not going to go to jail. And I think probably it's done him a whole lot of favors, because it's really for that hard right and that group of people that do think he's persecuted, it's reinforced every single one of their views.
Yeah. Yeah, you're either hard right or you're hard left, right? It's a hard year. Like over there, it's a lot of instability politically. And I think this is all happening at a point in time where you probably want to see a strong America so that we have a strong globe. Because rightly or wrongly, they currently are the global policemen at the moment. They might not be in the future. I certainly don't want to see that transition happen in an abrupt manner, but if a kingdom divided can't stand, it's pretty divided over there in the US. And I just wonder where that goes in terms of, the Russian situation, the Chinese situation, and what's happening in the Middle East. Fascinating times, eh?
Very. But
they are slowing down as well, right? So the U.S. Yeah. showing signs of economic slowdown. We're seeing the jobs data come back a little bit, not as sexy. At some stage, these higher for longer interest rates will bite, kind of like what we were talking about before. They seem to be biting quite quickly here in New Zealand, and now there's a little bit of momentum here. Much bigger ship in the U.S. to stop that. It takes a lot more work. We're seeing that right now, aren't we? And so heading up to an election, my suspicious mind says, well, we'll probably see the neck relieved of the pressure from the boot on it right before the elections to make the economy feel a bit better and increase optimism. But I'm not sure. Like, it kind of also feels like it's gone a little bit too far, you know?
It's a really hard one though, right? So you kind of, I think it was this morning, their relief, the job openings data. And actually, it's kind of coming back into line, right? There's 1.2 jobs out there at the moment for every person looking for a job. So actually, whereas previously there were 2 jobs for every one person kind of 12 months ago. So the job opening data is slowing down. We are starting to see the personal savings rates have kind of appear to be running out and appear to have come to an end. So all of that excess savings that we've had for the last couple of years through the New Zealand summer, we got ourselves thinking, maybe the real estate market had a few legs on it. That's starting to crumble as well. So where we've kind of seen, I think sales have kind of dropped off a cliff again. Some of these cracks are starting to appear in the US economy. And I think all of the signals around no landing, soft landing, people are starting to revisit some of that. But the beautiful thing about the way the markets are at the moment, good news is good news and bad news is good news. Because good news means the economy is going nuts and therefore earnings are going to keep going higher. Bad news just means interest rates are going to come down, which means earnings are going to get higher. So, hey, yeah. Great time to be an investor.
That's right. Hey, you can't lose, right? Welcome to the podcast.
That's game. Where a lot of people go right now.
Yeah. But, okay, so let's play devil's advocate on this whole kind of markets only go up, right? Higher for longer. We've spoken about this before.
Yeah.
It feels like, yeah, game of chicken and the Fed's playing a pretty good job of being the driver of that semi-rig coming straight towards, not flinching. No, we're going to stay the course. We're not dropping. We might even increase interest rates, right? Yeah. Mark has been shrugging that off. No, we can see straight through that. We know what's coming next. And there's still so much money in the system to be deployed. But in an environment where the market realizes that, no, they're not flinching. It is higher for longer, and it might even go higher. If that were to happen, where interest rates actually increased rather than decreased, or even just stayed the same, do you kind of think that we're going to have a situation with the 60-40 portfolio where it's going to be quite interesting? Because that's going to, like, I'm guessing higher interest rates from here. Well, that brings bond prices down.
Yeah.
You know, the investors see that coming. They're going to want to redeploy that money. Where are they going to put it? They're going to put it into equities. They're going to put it into commodities, gold, Bitcoin. They're going to put it into other places. So I guess the higher interest rates go, in a weird way, the better it is for all other assets. Am I reading that right?
No, yes and no. I think the two things that'll be kind of at play, right? One is, higher interest rates means a stronger economy. And so a stronger economy means higher earnings, means more demand for oil, more demand for all of these commodities that we use to drive our economy, right? So that's effectively, that is what higher interest rate means. It means we've got stronger growth and we've got better growth happening than we do. It also means we've got inflation. And again, we all know inflation is good for equities because companies can increase their prices and equities are a nice inflation hedge. So I think it potentially could be a good news story for equities. But I also think in terms of the long-term interest rates, I don't think they're going to move very much because at the end of the day, they will all believe that they are, at the end of the day, people are going to go, well, it's only short-term, it's going to come down. Like that cycle we've been in for the better part of the last 2 years where interest rates are perpetually kind of 3 to 6 months out. Markets have been forecasting interest rate declines for the last 18 months and the next 3 to 6 months. And so that's why I don't think people will see that as negative. I think they're going to take the positives out of it. The reallocating away from bonds, actually it could do the opposite. I mean, you might sit there and go, well, if I can lock in 5% for 5 years, with all the risks and everything that I see there in the equity market right now, that's not a bad outcome, right? I mean, I listened to two equity strategists this morning who violently agreed that there's no upside left in 2024. Hopefully markets kind of go through some peaks in 2025. And that's why their view is fixed interest is the place to be right now, because you can clip your 4.5-5% yield. You take some downside, you take some upside if interest rates come down, and you take it like that. So I do think we're in a really interesting spot. I do think markets will see interest rates going higher as a good news story, though, rather than a bad news story. I actually do think interest rates coming down, they will get their heads around it being a bad news story, because of the earnings and the economic growth assumptions that outline it, right? Let's be honest, the US market, it's made up of NVIDIA, Microsoft, Apple, Google, Meta, those big five that have gone a long way this year. I can't see a world in which Google is an advertising business, right? As the economy slows, they're going to have some hits on earnings. Apple, it's a consumer business. Again, they're going to have hits on earnings. Facebook, same kind of argument. The ones that are probably immune, much more so the Microsoft, the NVIDIA, some of those other big guys. But at some point, recession will hit earnings. And I think that is the core fundamental that does not change. And that's where we're going to land, is my suspicion.
Yeah, I know that there's more than one way to explain things, right? And I know what you're saying around, hey, we got a hot economy, therefore we'll see higher interest rates. Well, that's good because it means we have a hot economy. But I also know that inflation comes from governments and central banks. And so it's hard to separate these things and sometimes follow the alternative threads that cut through this. Same thing with earnings driving things. Sometimes the sentiment in the short term seems to be the dominant force, and the fundamentals that drive the long-term outcomes, they change. And they change so fast that it's hard to map it, right?
100%. And so one of the big arguments that great article somewhere talking about, I mean, housing market is actually the ultimate example of this, right? Over the last 5 years, or the last 15 years, house price to incomes have gone from kind of 4 times to 7 or 8 times in the US. New Zealand, they're even higher. And the argument, everyone said, but that's fine. We shouldn't worry about that because as interest rates are so much lower, the ability to service is the same. When do we start having the other side of that conversation? Equity markets is exactly the same, right? Oh, we're comfortable being 25 times PE because interest rates are low. And Warren Buffett very famously said about 4 or 5 years ago, if you believe interest rates are going to stay this low for forever, then equity markets are cheap right now and we should keep on buying. Yeah. Well, we've seen the other side of that, right? We're seeing 10-year bonds revert back to long-term averages. We're seeing mortgage rates revert back to long-term averages, but we haven't seen the movement in the asset prices. Mm. And that's the bit that I'm kind of very curious on to see whether that happened. So earnings growth, yes, but to your point, Darcy, there will be a paradigm shift at some point. It's just when that happens, who knows?
That's right. What is the length of a blip, right? Like if this is just a blip in high rates, but we're going to hook up again with that long-term trend basically over 40 years.
And I think most people are now saying that's not the case. Not many people are arguing that we're going to go back to this world of 2-3% interest rates, right? I think most people are saying we'll be lucky if we get 100 points of reduction from where we are. So kind of in New Zealand, we go from 5.5 down to 4.5. Yeah. Sticker rate on mortgages at the moment in New Zealand, 6.5 to 7. That might come in back into the fives. But I don't think many people are talking about that getting back into the fours.
No. Well, there's really only two options, right? We either see interest rates drop or we see house prices drop with that one, or drop further, especially adjusted for inflation, which no one really talks about. Like property prices have come down significantly when you adjust for inflation. But
they have, but to me, it all has to come back to affordability.
Yeah.
And I think our affordability ratios are way out of whack, and they are assuming kind of 3% interest rates come back.
Yeah. Well, and it'll take a while, I guess, for incomes to catch up. I don't know. If we knew, though, we would be doing pretty well. But because we don't know, or because
let's be honest, Darcy, we wouldn't be doing this if we knew what asset prices were about to do.
That's true. Which is probably a good timely reminder to say, hey, this is not financial advice, but I think you would be pretty crazy to be following this conversation and then jumping on your Sharesies app and making some bets. There's more to chat about, but we've gone way over time today. Yeah.
We'll talk Ethereum next week and the Ethereum ETFs. I think that's one of the other big ones, but we've got lots of time for that next week.
Awesome. All right. Good conversation. Thanks again, Rupert. We'll catch you next week.
Thanks, Darcy. It was a great conversation.